It's an honor and a pleasure and a privilege and all sorts of other things to be here with you in this place, a place that's very special to me and to my family. And a lot of my colleagues back in Valparaiso are jealous that I'm here and they're not. Although I found out when I called home just before coming in to check signals if there were any messages, I found out that my daughter had answered the phone the day before after I had already left, and my wife had no idea who it was who had called, but my daughter simply said, "Oh, he's not here, he went on vacation." So that's what Holden means to her. I have other things to say about being here with the group of people that is here this week, but this is almost an after-dinner speech, coming, you know, shortly after people have eaten. And after-dinner speakers, at least according to the form critical theories that I work with as an Old Testament scholar, you know, you need to use humor to start. So I thought I would take care of one little item of necessity here. If you looked at the topics I'm speaking about, you will have noticed that they stretch from Genesis almost to Revelation. They go as far as Romans, at least, and I'll cheat a little bit and move into 2 Corinthians. I didn't quite make it to Revelation, and though I was warned many years ago, never listen to a speaker who has to cover everything from Genesis to Revelation, I thought I would do it anyway by sharing with you a piece of stuff that came to me, like most things come these days on the internet, and this is a bit of stuff that'll help. Just, we'll be done with Revelation after this next moment here. You've heard of the number of the beast, 666. Well, did you know that 665.95 is the retail price of the beast? 699.25 is the price of the beast plus 5% sales tax. $769.95 is the price of the beast with all accessories and a replacement sole. $656.66 is the Walmart price of the beast. $00666 is the zip code of the beast. $1-900-666-0666. Live beasts! $666K is the retirement plan of the beast. I-66686 is the CPU of the beast. 666I is the BMW of the beast. Finally, 668 is the next door neighbor of the beast. So, having completed that, we're now done with Revelation. We can not worry about that. Seriously, it is a wonderful privilege to be here with a program that includes my friend Susan Briel, who does the devotions for us, and with whom I've had the great pleasure of working on things related to Holden over the last years. With Bill Fagey, with whom I got to serve on the Wheat Ridge Ministries board for at least a couple years that we overlapped, and he used to inspire us all the time in our meetings of that board with stories of things that are possible in this world that most people wouldn't believe. And then Douglas John Hall has been one of my teachers, though he wouldn't know it, through things that he's written, one of which was a letter to me back in 1979 when he had written a beautiful essay in Interpretation Journal on the novel Silence by Shusaku Endo. And I was so moved by the article that I just wrote him a brief note of thanks, and he wrote me back. And I still have the letter. And by chance, I got the letter telling me that it was time to send my theme for this conference during the week that Shusaku Endo died, which was approximately 1 year ago this week. And we had a Japanese foreign exchange student living with us at the time, and so I emailed her mother and asked her, did she know Shusaku Endo? And indeed she did. And so she began to share with me how the Japanese people as a whole felt about this wonderful Roman Catholic Christian writer, who was a dear, dear person to many in Japan who weren't even Christian. And so I started thinking about Shusaku Endo and his novel Silence as I thought about what I might talk about in the way of thinking through a biblical theme to help us think about things in a confused world. And Silence and its themes will run through what I have to say this week. If you know that story, it's the story of Jesuit missionaries who went to Japan in the 16th and 17th centuries and ultimately faced persecution. And in particular, one missionary goes to Japan partly to do mission work and partly to find his own teacher, whom he's heard has apostatized. And he is eventually captured, and the only way that he can save the lives of a bunch of Japanese Christian people whom he has tried to help is if he will apostatize by stomping on the image of a face of Christ. And he refuses to do this. And as the story concludes, this silent face of Christ on the floor finally speaks to him and demands that he step on the face. Trample, trample, says the face. It was to be trampled on by men that I was born into this world. It was to share men's pain that I carried my cross. So I'd like to probe what kind of freedom we could really live in if we could let go of our own burdens of righteousness and let Christ be our sacrifice. I'd like us to think together about what our lives might look like if the blood of Christ, the life of the Christ born to be trampled on, also coursed through our own veins and enlivened us and gave shape and structure to our lives. I think there is a huge irony to the Christian life. There is freedom for us from all, including the sufferings that Christ bore for us. But there is freedom also, and a calling too, to bear the cross and the suffering of others on behalf of that Christ in this world. One of the vexations of this confused world is difficulty in discerning when to let Christ bear the trampling and when we need to be in the role of the trampled on ourselves. And another is that of avoiding just going with the flow and being carried along down the streams of the culture, bowing down, as I would call it, to the golden calf of the free market, as free market economies dictate finally to everyone how to do everything, and that includes the church. I know folks whose language includes statements like this: we worship 80% of our baptized membership. Just think of that use of the verb to worship. Or just Friday in the mail, I couldn't resist dragging this out along with me. This is a mailing I got Friday from one of the fastest growing churches in Northwest Indiana. It's called the Nice Church. And Nice stands for the Northwest Indiana Church of Encouragement. And evidently it works. it's easy enough to get on the bandwagons of things that are just being swept along in the free market, but that's not the Eucharistic life into which we are baptized. The Eucharistic life is not in the pattern that the free market would establish. I'm going to talk about the Eucharistic life as a habit. And a habit is a place to live. Habitus. It's something we're inside of. A place to live, a condition, a nature, and a way of being. And what is that Eucharistic habit, that habitus we cultivate as lifelong Christians? Many of you have been practicing it much longer than I. You've been exploring that in many, many ways, but that's what I'd like to talk about over the next couple of days, the shape of the Eucharistic life, the habitus that we inhabit when we make this our home. And I'm going to begin in Genesis. The Eucharist obviously begins at least as far back as Exodus, everyone knows, because on the night when Jesus was betrayed, that night the Christian tradition remembers over and over and over again, he was in the midst of celebrating Passover, which is an Exodus story. But I'm going to push back even deeper into the stories of Genesis, indeed all the way to the primal history, where confusion reigns from the outset. And there are a lot of ways you could begin to talk about that confusion, but what I'd invite you to do just for a moment is to listen carefully to several of the questions that are the first questions in the Bible. And just think how many different ways these questions could be answered, or what all these questions might be asking. This is the Bible's first question. Did God really say? Then God's first question, where are you? Who told you you were naked? Who did tell them, by the way? And then a bit later, where is your brother? And after that, am I my brother's keeper? And soon enough, we find ourselves in the tangle of these questions, in a pattern of tragedy. Every one of the stories of the primal history, I learned this first from Terry Fretheim's book, Creation, Fall, and Flood, which I still think is a wonderful classic about Genesis. Every one of those stories, beginning with Genesis 3, has the same pattern. Things run amok. God takes note and discovers. God responds with curse and punishment, but God insists on keeping things going. Beginning with the forbidden fruit, God's discovery and conversation, God's curse, but God sews them leather clothes because they look so silly in those fig leaves. But the nakedness must be covered somehow. Then with the brothers, God discovers the absence of the one brother. God responds with curse. But God marks the one brother against vengeance, lest God loses all the brothers. And then it escalates to grand themes with Noah. And again, we have sin, curse. But God keeps the show on the road with Noah's family. And so we all end up the children of Noah, whose banquet of wine resumes the cycle of shame and the curse that the human family continues to live with. But in that story, God learns a lesson, the way Genesis tells the story. As the story opens, God observes that these human beings why they think about nothing but evil in the imaginations of their hearts from their youth. And after all of the destruction and the earth wiped clean with all that water, God looks around and says, you know, the human beings are evil in the imagination of their heart from their youth. The water didn't fix a thing. You can nuke them all you like, and it doesn't help. And so God swears that that will never be the solution again. And so it is that after the scattering of human beings into all their myriad of families, cut off by languages, finally comes God's new response. Instead of curse, it must now be blessing. These people, Abram and Sarai, will be God's last hope for the world. And if this does not work, then what? But what would blessing look like? What is the blessing with which all the families of the earth shall be blessed through these people? That word blessing is in some ways very complex, in others very simple. Blessing comes from the root for knee. And to bless is, first of all, to kneel. The image is simple enough. To be blessed is to kneel before someone, some Lord, who can give you whatever that Lord chooses to give, whether it's a blow to the head, or land, or progeny. And of course, on your knees, you can't escape. You're going to get what's given. So what gifts would all the families of the earth receive if they knelt before this people, Abram and Sarah, and their offspring? Well, the Christians would eventually say, of course, that it was the Messiah. But that's all much later. And ultimately, the family of Abram and Sarah would say it's the Torah. Because the program for the Jewish community, and especially the Pharisaic Jewish community, which was the only one to survive the Roman Jewish wars, except for the family of Jews known as the Christians, saw Torah as their heritage. That would be God's great gift to the world through them. And a good gift it is, because if we could have a world where people did not steal, or murder, or dishonor parents, or make toys of people's bodies, or destroy reputations, wouldn't it be a different world? And wouldn't we be at least one step closer to God realizing God's dream when making this world? But here's another thought. Just for fun, let's do a slightly different sort of reading of this ancient story and the blessing that we might get from this people. I'm going to do a reading of this story through the names of the children of these people, at least the ones who get the most attention. It was not Ishmael, the older son of Abram, through whom the promise came to us, but Yitzhak, Isaac. And we all know, I think, probably that his name means he laughs. Laughter. It's wonderful onomatopoeia. The Hebrew verb to laugh is pronounced tzakak. Why is he named that? Is it because his father laughed at the promise, as he did in Genesis 17? Fell down on his face, not in worship, but in laughter at God's promise. Was it because Sarah laughed at the promise in chapter 18, which she did in the tent. What a joke those three visitors told. But the name does not come from either of those two incidents. The name comes from the moment when the child is born in Genesis 21. And Sarah says this, and I'm translating literally from the Hebrew a little better than what you see in most English Bibles. Sarah said, "God made laughter for me. All who hear will laugh with me." So this child is not named for laughter at. This child is named for laughter with. And that is a blessing, to be able to laugh with instead of laughing at. And if you understand Genesis the way I do, it was for that kind of laughter that God made the world, that there might be laughter with, when there's so much of laughter at. Again, in the next generation, the older child is left out and the younger gets the blessing, this time not Esau, but Jacob. Jacob, whose name means he grasps, he supplants, or as some translate it, he cheats. But we know his name was changed to Israel. The derivation is a bit shaky, but the tradition says it means he wrestles with God. Recall the story there in Genesis 32. After all the years of struggling to make a go of it back in the land of the ancestors, Jacob is ready to come home to face the brother from whom he fled to save his life when he cheated his brother and his father as well from the way the blessing should have gone down in the family. Jacob doesn't know exactly what he'll confront when he goes back to meet Esau. And I know that there are a number of ways to read what Jacob did that night, but the plain facts are this, that he stayed behind and he sent the women and children on ahead across the river out to where that brother waited. And in that night, as Jacob waited till the time when he would cross, there came the night stranger. The stranger who wrestled with him all through the night, wrestled to a draw, who finally begged for release, and Jacob said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And the stranger blessed him and said, "Now you are Israel, for you have striven with God and with men, and you have prevailed." In that night, Jacob learned that his real battle in life was not with Esau after all. His real struggle in life was with God. And what a blessing if we could all learn that that's where our true struggles are. Not with our brothers and sisters, but with God. And if we wrestled with God instead of our brothers and sisters, that would be a blessing. If only Cain had known that when he was so angry at God for looking past his offering. So angry at God was he that the only thing he could think to do was to wring God's pet's neck. And what about the rest of us? Aren't most of our battles really not with each other, but with God? And in the next generation, Not Reuben, not Simeon, not Levi, but Judah. All of them the sons of Leah, the wife that Jacob didn't want, the one he did not love. The narrator tells us in Genesis 9 that when God saw that Leah was unloved and Rachel loved, God opened Leah's womb and Rachel's remained closed. And each time Leah had a child, bore that husband of hers a son, she just knew that now that man would love her, and that's all she wanted. So when the first baby came, she said, "Now he will see." And she named him Reuben, for the verb of sight. But Jacob did not love her. And when the next child came, she said, "Now I have been heard." She just knew that now he would love her. Two boys, what more could he ask? She named him Simeon, the verb of hearing. But Jacob did not love her. And the third time always works. So when the third time came, she knew that now this man would be joined to her. And so she named this child Levi. Entwined, joined. But Jacob did not love her. When the fourth child was born, the narrator says, Leah said, "This time I will thank God." And she named him Judah, which is a verb that means this. It's a verb that means a gesture. Yada means to throw, to heave, to shoot. And I don't know how you picture her gesture in that moment and why she named that baby that. I mean, it could have been this man, you know. Or it could have been gentler. What are you going to do? You know, the guy's an idiot. Gets me pregnant every year. Loves me not at all. But I choose to see her as our mother in the faith. Because what she did in that moment was she quit the project of trying to earn love with the things that she could do, which in her case was to make babies for a thankless man. Who knows what she really wanted? If she only wanted simple love, or if she wanted the place that her sister had, she wanted to be the favored one, who knows? But she is our mother in the faith because she quit it all, and she simply said, "Thank God. Forget Jacob. Thank God for this child." And she named him Judah, which means, "Oh, give thanks." Like all these names, there is debate about whether the stories reflect truly accurate derivations. But this story says that the name comes from Judah, and so I accept that. The root meaning is to throw, as I've said. And if you want to see some texts where you find the verb in use, you'll find a wonderful ambiguity. Psalm 54. if you're writing this down, it's verse 6 in English, verse 8 in Hebrew. With a free will offering, I will sacrifice to you. I will give thanks to your name, O Lord, for it is good. But now, Psalm 32, verse 5. Then I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not hide my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. Or again, Proverbs 28, no one who conceals transgressions will prosper, but one who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy. So to give thanks and to give back one's sins, it's the same gesture. It's an ambiguous gesture. So I guess maybe we can let Leah have done both. And but to me, perhaps the most interesting of all is in Jonah 2, at the end of the poem that he wrote in the belly of the fish, which is a marvelous place to write poetry. But after Jonah has run away from the charge to go and say five words. Remember, that's all that was needed, was five words. He refused to use his voice for those five words. But this is his poem. But I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. Or in Hebrew, I, with a thrown up voice, that voice, will sacrifice to you. For salvation belongs to the Lord. Well, Jonah still had a lot to learn about whether salvation really did belong to the Lord or whether he could squeeze the pipeline. But this was also a gesture of quitting a project of controlling what God would forgive or not forgive for God's enemies, or at least for Jonah's. So it's wonderfully ambiguous. And of course, this is the gesture of prayer to this day, even among us. Think of the times that Judah, the man with his name, must have thrown up his hands in his lifetime. Surely, for example, he must have thrown up his hands one way or another in the moment in Genesis 38 when he realizes he was the one who got the daughter-in-law pregnant, whom he was about to have stoned for being pregnant out of wedlock, when he finally said to her, I see you are more righteous than I. The verb is not there, but I'll bet his hands were up. Or in the Joseph cycle, it is Judah. And here I want to start a little thing that will turn into a big thing tomorrow and the next day. It is Judah who speaks the word that saves Joseph's life. And by saving Joseph's life, Judah saved Israel. Because without Joseph, as Professor Hall indicated this afternoon, Israel was lost. Because it was Judah who said, amidst the plot to kill Joseph outright, what profit is it if we kill our brother? Let's just sell him. Well, what kind of saving word is that? You know, let's sell our brother to the Ishmaelites. That's a word of treachery. It's a terrible thing to do to a brother, to sell him to slavers. And yet the alternative was to kill him. So the word of treachery is the word of salvation. And I wonder if Judah's hands weren't up. Let's just sell him. And then, of course, it is Judah who negotiates with Jacob, his father, when they have to go back to Israel, this time with Benjamin. And Jacob will not hear of this. And Judah begs. And he makes himself the price, along with his own children. This is the heir who came to bear one of God's people's most common names. Always they are Israel, the one who wrestles with God. But they also became the people of Judah after Ephraim was destroyed by the Assyrians. And they became Judea when the Greeks came, and it was from being known as Judea that he became known as the Jews, a name they still bear, the people heaved heavenward by their mother and our mother Leah. And we claim to be grafted into that family. We too are the heavers and the heaved. We are the children of Leah, the unloved mother. The mother who, with the birth of our ancestor Judah, gave up the project of being loved. Something died with her in this birth, just as surely as her sister died in bearing Benoni, son of my sorrow, whose name got changed to Benjamin, because Jacob couldn't stand to hear all of that sorrow. So we are the children, the heirs, grafted into that family of Mother Leah, who gave up something precious. I think we are to see ourselves in both Leah and Judah in this story, and I have several points to ponder here as I will close, even though it's 15 minutes, less than an hour. How much of our lives don't we spend devoted to bearing fruit for a husband like Jacob, especially before he became Israel? A husband of some kind or another who may be angry with some Laban or another, but who takes it out on us and hates us for what someone else did. And we try to earn that someone's love, or whatever we think love might be. How many of you don't spend your lives and your energy doing the equivalent of bearing children to husbands who cannot love you? Perhaps because they are incapable of love, or because they don't know how to be loved, and they couldn't receive or give love, no matter how faithfully it was imaged for them. We become a priestly people with Leah when we finally give up our projects of trying to earn love or deserve love. And that's when holy things happen. When we're on our knees and we throw up our hands in thanks for what we do have, rather than living and dying for what we don't have. And in that posture, too, We learn with Leah that our children are never, ever our own. Our children are never our bargaining chips or our proofs of purchase for things we list on whatever counts for our resumes in the church or in any other vocation. And I mean for you to translate children in that thought into whatever person or persons you are prone to speak of as mine, as in my spouse, or my students, or my clients, or my congregation, or my synod, or my district. These all become holy when we remember that they are not our own, but they are God's gifts, given that we might return them in thanks. But we are not only Leah, our mother. We are Judah, our brother, the one heaved to heaven, the one offered up, given back to God, let go of by those who birthed and raised and loved and kept us. We too are given away as gifts, blessings for all the families of the earth, given away to a world that knows only the curse and the free market and the thrills of justice and vengeance and being number one. And that's a dangerous thing to be thrown into, especially as a gift. And finally, we are Judah when we remember also to confess our sins, to lay down our righteousness, and to let Christ, not ourselves in our righteousness and our rightness, be the ones to bear the weight of the world's trampling, and more on that tomorrow. Thank you.